Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Matthew Smith, in for Julie Glenn. Dr. Lauren Zettler is a biology professor at Illinois College in Jacksonville, Illinois, where he directs the Orchid Recovery Program. It specializes in finding and preserving the unique species of fungi that orchids require to grow and survive. In his lab, he uses the fungus species he's collected in research trips across the globe to grow endangered orchids from seeds and then reintroduce those seedlings back into the wild. Originally from Gainesville, he was in Southwest Florida last week with his undergraduate students who are preparing for a month of work in the Florida Panther Wildlife Refuge in Collier County. They're working for the third year with Cuban orchid expert Dr. Ernesto Mojica, who's working with the students to study orchids found in Florida and elsewhere in countries like Cuba and Ecuador. Dr. Zettler, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Let's start with your students. Can you tell me exactly what they'll be doing with Dr. Mojica when they're working with him in the Collier Wildlife Refuge?
Dr. Mojica will be working with the two students on the ghost orchid surveys that are ongoing at the Panther Refuge. We have 4 years of data to collect, and Dr. Mojica will be able to make accurate predictions on the fate of the ghost orchid in the natural areas in South Florida to compare to the Cuban populations in Cuba. We're very optimistic that the ghost orchid, with Dr. Kane's propagation in our surveys in South Florida with the Cuban experts, that we're going to keep that species here for a long time. And we're excited about the Cuba connection that we have to study the orchids there as well. And we think that the orchids of the South Florida and the Caribbean have a bright future.
The ghost orchid is almost like a mythological plant. It's been the subject of books, movies, tall tales about how it actually does reproduce. Does it have an outsized role in people's minds as an orchid of interest, or is it really that unique?
Well, I'd say it's very unique for a number of reasons. In terms of the Florida orchids, North American orchids, it is leafless as an adult. So it grows by roots affixed to the bark of trees in swamps, dark, dismal, mosquito-infested swamps.
Safe from any humans who might want to interfere with it.
Exactly. And so those of us who are inclined to go in these swamps and swat mosquitoes and evade alligators and so on will be rewarded by the beautiful sight of the flower hanging, which seems like in midair, over the water. And it kind of hovers there. You can't really see the leaves because it has none. And the white flower against the dark backdrop in the shadows gives it the impression or illusion of a ghost. And if you get close enough toward sunset, you can smell the flowers, which are quite appealing as well. They're fragrant, sweet smelling. They attract what we think is a giant sphinx moth for pollination. So everything about this thing, when you finally see it for the first time, it kind of locks you in a way where it you'll never forget it.
That sphinx moth, you mentioned, we think that's how it reproduces. Tell me about the anatomy of the ghost orchid and that moth, and what makes it such a difficult thing to understand, this reproductive cycle of this orchid?
Well, for one thing, there are videos, and occasionally you hear stories of people that have seen the moth and videotaped it visiting these flowers. To my knowledge, there's no one who's ever captured a moth pollinator of this orchid with the pollen on the eyes or the tongue of the insect. So until we actually have someone that shows evidence of a visit or a pollination event, we really don't know what that is. However, the flower has a very long nectar spur, which is filled with nectar, and it matches the length of the giant sphinx moth, which flies here at the same time that it is pollinated. And in addition to that, this orchid likes to grow on the tree of the giant sphinx moth larval food source. So we think that the evidence is pointing that direction.
And like you said, we're still awaiting that conclusive evidence. Do orchids usually have such a close, I venture to say, symbiotic relationship when it comes to their reproductive cycle, or is this an unusual type of orchid?
I would say overall the orchid family are master manipulators. They have learned and evolved strategies to cater to specific insects sometimes that the insect also needs as well. So the orchids have learned to lure certain specific pollinators in many parts of the world for their specific needs for, you know, reproduction. In addition to that, not only do they manipulate insects and pollinators, they manipulate fungi for their seed germination needs. And so orchids are unbelievable. And they also manipulate people in many ways because many of us like orchids and we collect them, and our wallets are sometimes empty after these shows. And so I would say the orchids in general are, the more you study them, the more you find out how they have figured things out.
Right. And I'd like to touch on your work with orchids and fungi in a moment. But first, I want to ask about just the range of orchids. You've studied them from Hawaii to Madagascar. You said they're found all the way up to Alaska, almost anywhere except Antarctica and maybe some of the driest deserts. Where did these mysterious plants originally come from, and how did they spread to so many different parts of the globe?
Well, what I understand of the evolution of the orchid family is it owes its origins to Asia and about the time of the dinosaurs, toward the end of the dinosaur age. They spread from there. Their seeds are very dust-like, like wind. The wind can carry the seeds for long distances, and they have spread to different parts of the world, mostly in the tropical areas where the trees and the rainforest lie. We think orchids started out at the ground level and moved into trees as they began to evolve. In North America and South America, orchid diversity is quite high. Most of the orchids in the Western Hemisphere are in Colombia and Ecuador, which has a lot along the Andes.
And you mentioned that a single tree somewhere in Ecuador, say, could have more species of orchids than all of North America. Is there anything that accounts for that kind of diversity down there and why it's such a sparse number of orchid species in other parts of the world?
Well, that's one of the questions that a lot of us have in the field. But what we think happens is orchids, because they can specialize in specific pollinators, they can speciate. And what I'd like to know is, can orchids manipulate fungi to the extent to their evolutionary needs as well?
Now, when you say they can speciate, is that to say when orchids find a niche, they can really fit in there and create a very unique circumstance where they ensure that this new species survives?
Correct.
What are some of the changes that perhaps evolutionarily you've been able to track these orchids evolve, changes they've been able to adapt to allow them to fill those niches?
Well, that's a question that many of the experts in the molecular areas are looking at. I can tell you from my work with the ghost orchid, the fungus that we were able to find in the roots of this thing appears to be a unique fungus. And so it might be that the ghost orchid is utilizing this one particular fungus for its needs, which could account for its speciation in that direction.
Is that to say we don't see that species of fungus anywhere else where we don't see the ghost orchid?
We have done the DNA sequencing on this fungus, and it has not turned up in the databases so far. So we think it's a unique fungus in the genus Serrata basidium, which is rather widespread. But this particular strain of fungus has not been found yet.
I've read in some scientific news articles about species of ants that almost farm a fungus that they use for food. Even the screwworm that I believe is affecting so many trees in certain parts. Forgive me, I don't believe it's a screwworm. It's a species of beetle and fungus that it has in its gut. They almost farm that fungus when they're inside that tree. Is it too out there to say that perhaps this orchid farms or deliberately grows this fungus to help itself proliferate?
The general idea of what you just said is tempting. But what really happens with orchids is that the fungus is out there doing its own thing, decomposing leaf litter, wood, so on. And it just happens to run into an orchid seed. And the orchid seed then uses that fungus and pretty much uses it as a food source to germinate. So the fungus really doesn't need the orchid. The orchid needs the fungus, and the fungus has taken advantage of it as a food source.
Not to step away from your area of expertise, but I do want to ask a bit about kind of the travel bug in me that wants to ask about some of your travels. And we'd be remiss if we did a conversation, a show about orchids, and we didn't talk about the startling visual variety that they have. Tell us, take us on a kind of a trip to some of the places and some of the species you've seen. What stands out to you as just somebody who appreciates the beauty of these flowers? What are some of the really wild types of orchids you've been able to see working across the country, across the world, really?
Well, I'd like to start here in South Florida for one thing. The Florida orchids that we have here in Collier County are the North American ground central zero. It's just the diversity of the North American continent, and we have a lot of beauty here. But when we break out of this North American area, I would say three areas really stand out. In Ecuador, I was able to go to the Andes, and I could see many of the orchids in the trees. I remember seeing a genus called Dracula, which does look like a face. And if you want to say it looks like Dracula, so be it. But it does look like a face. In Hawaii, I was disappointed because the three native orchids of Hawaii are not as appealing as you might think. When you hear Hawaii, you think of beautiful blooms, massive purple, red blooms. But it's not the case. The orchids of Hawaii are, I would have to say, are a little disappointing on visuals. The orchids of Hawaii, and especially one in particular, the bog orchid there, is in very serious risk of extinction. And going there and bringing back seedlings to that island archipelago was an honor. I can say that in that travel, the last day I was there, we had to evacuate the hotel because of a tsunami that happened to be the one that Fukushima, the day Fukushima was hit. So we finished planting seedlings in the mountains of Hawaii and were then hit by this tsunami, and that was an experience.
Did that impact the work you had done there?
Not quite. We gave some seedlings to one of my colleagues who took a ferry across to Maui, and apparently he just beat the wave that came in. So we were very lucky there.
Who knew orchids would have such close calls?
Well, it's funny because – and not funny because in Madagascar when I was there for two trips, the last trip I took an Illinois college student and we went as a collaboration with the Royal Botanic Gardens.
If you could help me orient myself, Madagascar is that island off the southeast coast of Africa. Is that right?
Correct. It's very far away, 8 hours to London or Paris from here and then 12 hours over Africa. And in Madagascar, we were there with the Q team. And looking at some spectacular orchids that look like ghost orchids in many respects. They're white, fragrant. And we were told the day before we were going that we were in for a cyclone was coming in, and it was unexpected. It was during the rainy season. We spent the whole next day getting stuck twice. We were hit before we could get to our campsite. I fell into a trench. I was close to had a close call there, but after the event, after the cyclone hit, we went out into the countryside, and I got to see chameleons with the little eyes moving back and forth and the curly tails. I got to hold these chameleons, and I got to look at the most beautiful orchids I think I've seen anywhere. And it's really sad in a way because Madagascar has lost 90% of its forest. But it was quite a spectacular sight to see what they did have.
Overall, I want to ask about the threats that orchids are facing across the world and how the various species are doing. I asked you, before we get to those questions, though, I asked you about any spectacular visuals or unique orchids you saw. And you've mentioned a couple times about how fragrant they can be. Do they all have a similar fragrance, or do you find some that have a really unique or special fragrance?
Well, seems like people have different ways of detecting odors. I would say I'm average on that. I do use my nose a lot. In fact, I'll share something with you and your audience. I take other people in my field out into the field, and I share with them the orchid root, and I'll break it apart or remove it to get the fungus that I want. But I ask them to smell the root. The fungus root system seems to have a unique odor. And I mentioned this to the Q team in Madagascar, and they were very much interested in that, and they said, sure enough, the fungus was there and it didn't have the smell.
What does that smell? What does it smell like?
I can't describe it other than to me, it vaguely smells like dishwashing liquid. But as far as the flowers go, orchids are unique in many different species of different smells. There's one in Cuba, I can tell you, that smells a dead ringer for chocolate. If you close your eyes and you have this particular flower come to your nose and you have a normal nose, you'll smell chocolate. The one at the Panther Refuge that's out there smells like honey. And again, it's a dead ringer for honey, in my opinion. Depends on who you talk to.
Wow. So of a wide tapestry of smells and also visuals that these orchids present.
But they're not always pleasant smells. Some orchids cater to carrion flies. And so if you put your nose up to perhaps a Dracula orchid, the reason the genus Dracula might be more apt is because I think some of them smell like carrion, rotting flesh.
And that, interesting to note, that's the only species that doesn't appear in a mirror when you put it in a mirror in front of that plant. I'm joking, of course. If we could talk about your work with the fungus and the seeds of orchids, what are you trying to accomplish with that work? What is it that you're able to do that is able to assist orchid populations?
Well, my work is a specialty because we use fungi, as I say, to grow these from seed. When you put the right fungus with the right seed species, you'll get an almost amazing transformation. In a matter of weeks, you can see seedlings developing leaves. Orchid seeds are like dust. You can hardly see them with the naked eye. But when you have a fungus that's right one that you put with the seed, literally you come back in 2 weeks, 3 weeks in the lab and you look in the petri dish and you'll see these beautiful little baby seedlings begging for light. And so what we do in the lab is we try to go out and match these fungi with these seeds. And these orchids need the fungus to survive. And my goal as a researcher is to find these fungi that nobody else seems to want to look at. A lot of people do now, but didn't used to be that way. And I like to find these matches and then save the fungus and put them in the refrigeration and cryopreservation so that my daughter one day can maybe use these fungi to grow the orchids that are extinct in the wild. We have to have these fungal banks and you stockpile these orchid fungi so that they have something to eat someday.
People think about the kinds of seed banks, you know,
exactly.
Preserving seeds. But you're saying for orchids, it's just as important to preserve these fungal species.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, the North American Orchid Conservation Center, which we're part of, connected to, is a fungus and seed bank national connection place for the storage of fungi now. And we're part of that. We're collecting isolations of fungi here at the refuge and out in South Florida for the seed bank and the fungus bank.
And it would seem that it's not a one-size-fits-all fungus. The fungus that helps a ghost orchid thrive is not going to be any use of or particular use, I imagine, to other species, right?
Well, I think you're a natural ecologist when you ask that. You hit a very interesting question. There are some fungi that many different kinds of orchids will use just fine, and they'll grow. But some fungi are specific to a certain orchid or vice versa. So the right thing to do as an ecologist is to not go crazy and take one fungus from, say, Madagascar and match it with a seed from a Florida orchid and then put the fungus into Florida with that seedling. You don't want to do that. You could, in the laboratory, show that this fungus and this orchid from Madagascar, say, work together. But we kind of have to make sure we keep the fungi close to home where they came from originally so that you keep these habitats safe.
Are your efforts to both preserve some of these fungi and also match them to the right orchids, you mentioned earlier that that's something you can see the difference when the seed is working with the right fungus and the new orchids that bloom as a result, so that start to grow. Are you taking those back into the wild to try and rejuvenate wild populations?
Correct. There was a population of a Spiranthes orchid here in North Florida. It was down to one population, and our students at Illinois College grew that thing very quickly in the laboratory, and we reintroduced it, and it started flowering 16 months after it was germinated. So that's what we try to do. We try to take these seedlings back to these habitats and to, you know, reintroduce them augment the populations that are currently there.
To bring our conversation back to the ghost orchid, I know it's almost a tightly guarded secret anytime anybody knows where ghost orchids are blooming. I imagine that has a lot to do with the black market for orchids, but also because they are so rare, you don't want to subject them to, you know, the hordes of tourists who would love to take a photo of a ghost orchid in the wild. I guess when we're thinking about this conservation in South Florida, what species do you see as really need some extra help to help them return to the numbers that they've had in the past? What species are doing well?
The ghost orchid would certainly be one of those. The estimates I've heard are around 2,000. We have other species like the cigar orchid that need to be and have been propagated. I'd like to point out that some advancements made by Dr. Mike Kane at the University of Florida and his PhD student really pretty much showed the way to how to propagate the ghost orchid, and they have been pioneers in that. We have given them fungi to Gainesville, and that fungus has worked. So Dr. Kane's group in Gainesville has pretty much spearheaded the propagation of the ghost orchid artificially. There are now seedlings at the Naples Botanical Garden that you can see that came from his lab, and that's a success story. The ghost orchid is growable, and it's becoming more visible now. You're going to see more of it, and there'll be less need to go out and poach it. That's one of the goals for propagation. We want to reduce the likelihood that people are going to poach it. If you can simply buy it, et cetera, someday, have it that way, why would you want to go poach it? And it doesn't make any sense.
You know, we started our conversation off with how orchids can often lighten the wallets of people who do enjoy them. I want to ask you if being an orchid fan and buying orchids and seeing them at shows, is that, is that a healthy pastime or or are you kind of on the borderline of encouraging poaching and things like that? What would an orchid expert say to the orchid fans out there?
Enjoy. Don't break any rules. Try to learn as much as you can. I am a son of a professor at the University of Florida who studied orchid viruses, and he exposed me to the orchid family many years ago, and I didn't really care for orchids, to be honest, at that time as a child. But I got to see some of the lunacy of the people and that were associated with orchids, and it was very intriguing as a boy. As I grew up, I began to connect more with the orchidists, and I can see where they're coming from. It's you don't have to break rules and to poach things to enjoy these plants. And my advice also would be to experience these plants in the wild, because people can make discoveries. They might actually catch the pollinator of the ghost orchid if they're just there at the right time. There are discoveries to be made. You can also cater to your interest in orchids by visiting the Naples Botanical Garden. Also, the Naples Orchid Society is a very vibrant group that encourages native orchid conservation, and you can connect there.
So there are healthy outlets. You can also, if you go in thinking with the right mentality, you can contribute to our knowledge instead of stealing an orchid specimen for yourself. Final question, and then I'll leave it to you if you have any other thoughts. But final question, I guess, is for people who have seen orchids, you know, maybe seen some beautiful pictures, and maybe even stopped by a show where they've seen some orchids on display. It's a beautiful plant, a lot of dizzying varieties. If somebody wants to start learning how to more carefully appreciate orchids, what's your suggestion? Can they see them on the side of the road or in a trip to the Big Cypress National Preserve here in South Florida? Should they start attending shows? How can people bone up on their orchid appreciation?
Well, one thing you could do is connect with the local orchid society. There's a lot of knowledgeable people that want to show you these orchids and these plants. They want to get you excited about them. So it's easy to do. You just get to know the right person, and then it's downhill from there.
Downhill?
Well, let me say it this way. My student, who's at the Panther Refuge right now, I asked him, my former student, I said, have you bought any orchids yet from the hobbyists? And he said, oh, yeah, I have 16 of them. I said, well, it's over. because now you're hooked and you're going to get more of them and you're going to want to know more of them. And so it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
It's a slippery slope, though. Once you get hooked, you're hooked.
It's over in a good way. Once you start, you'll see what I mean.
Well, Dr. Lauren Zettler, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Lauren Zettler is a biology professor at Illinois College in Jacksonville, Illinois, where he directs the Orchid Recovery Program. Gulf Coast Live today was produced by Julie Glenn and myself, Matthew Smith. Our director was Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Matthew Smith. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM. NPR for Southwest Florida.